dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Some listeners have written to ask me to do coverage on the financial crisis to counter the spin and obfuscation being broadcast in the corporate media. In terms of analysis by economists of the administration bailout plan, Democracy Now! Has been providing excellent coverage over the last week that illuminates the power grab. It points out how there is never enough money to provide health care for the people, for example, but always enough to bail out Wall Street. I recommend you listen to it, if you haven't heard it, at democracynow.org. I would like to take a different approach on the issue. One topic of debate is whether the urgency for action is real or a scheme to ram through some sort of financial Patriot Act. Many within the financial world have been warning of such a financial collapse as a result of the deadly brew of credit and leverage cooked up by Wall Street bankers. I can tell you that there are many financial analysts who are not fans of the administration and its policies or the current practices on Wall Street who nevertheless do believe that the economic system is on the verge of collapse. They, however, don't believe that the $700 billion bailout will solve the problem, as is more or less being claimed. Furthermore, many analysts within the financial system have announced both the bailout and the actions that led to it as an orgy of criminality in terms unusual in the normally staid financial analyst sector. I'm not going to attempt to resolve that question here in the program. The question that isn't part of the official debate within capitalism is the one that most interests me. That is, whether this system ought to survive at all, rather than how to save it. And beyond that, how to apply social leverage to an already toppling system. A person whom I recently corresponded with cautioned that I ought to be careful what I wished for, as economic collapse would be horrible. It will be, but not so horrible, ultimately, as the alternative. The continuation of this insane system, which is threatening life on the planet, one that forecloses sane alternatives as long as it maintains its hegemony. We'll explore that question in depth this week with author Derek Jensen. Capitalism has a fatal flaw. It must either result in monopoly or seek endless growth to maintain and increase profits. It has some sort of economic crisis every decade, cycles of booms and busts, with waste during the booms and hardship during the busts. One thing it's not about is meeting needs. We can see that quite clearly in the present tragic and absurd state of affairs. The news is full of reports on the increasing number of homes standing empty due to foreclosure, and meanwhile, tent cities are springing up in various former boom towns. A system that was about meeting needs would do a very simple calculation. Empty homes, homeless people, put the people in the homes, problem solved. Our species, like other animals, was able to provide food, shelter, tools, culture, and community for hundreds of thousands of years without money, banks, or bankers. We have been convinced or coerced into submitting to a regime that creates scarcity and waste simultaneously. How we're kept in this situation is a topic of our ongoing reading, Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Its fatal flaw is that it relies on buying and selling to generate profits. Its proponents promise it will bring general prosperity, but it is actually a system that leads to wealth concentration. Just like the board game Monopoly many of us played as children, the game is over when one player has bankrupted the rest. Once a player has had the luck to corner a critical mass of properties, dispossession of the other players is only a matter of time, as the money supply is finite. In real life, society is faced with millions or billions of people unable to even meet the most basic needs as a result of wealth concentration. Thus, the state intervenes to increase money supply through permitting the issuance of credit. This leads to wasteful overconsumption and ultimately the reconsolidation of money in a few hands through a process like we are now seeing, called recession, depression, contraction, and the cycle starts over. What we are seeing now is the latest attempt at a workaround of capitalism's weaknesses that has reached the end of its rope. The bankers had to lend to people who couldn't afford to repay the loans because they had run out of people who could afford to pay. They thought, or hoped, they had worked out a way to do it with impunity. They invented various financial instruments that were supposed to minimize the risk of credit default by dispersing it. But what they created instead was like an interlocking house of cards that caves in when a card is removed. One of the financial analysts who has been predicting a meltdown of this sort for years is Doug Noland, editor of the Credit Bubble Bulletin. He is part of what you might call a dissident faction within capitalism. Here, he explains in an interview with Jim Plava, a money manager who hosts the popular Conservative Financial Sense podcast, how credit default derivatives were supposed to function as insurance and why they failed to live up to their theoretical models. The terms credit default swaps, securitization, collateralized debt obligations, over-the-counter derivatives, mortgage-backed securities all refer to these financial instruments that are supposed to provide insurance against risk. The first voice is host Jim Plava.
You know, one thing that has been surprising, and I mean, the day you and I are talking, we had a sharp jump in unemployment claims, new home sales were down 11%, we had a sharp contraction in durable good orders, so we're seeing this go over into the economic side. And what has been surprising, if you look at the measures that have been taken by the government, whether it was slashing interest rates, all the different lending facilities that the Fed has done, the bailout of various financial institutions, takeovers, the $300 billion program to bail out homeowners this summer, now $700 billion. Have you been surprised at the, or at least alarmed at all of these measures have become necessary, and we're not even talking about, you know, like a major recession yet? I mean, we're moving in that direction, but what happens, Doug, when people get laid off? I mean, 2 weeks ago, HP said it was laying off 25,000 workers. You know, what happens when we get those kind of headlines?
And, Jim, that is what has me so worried. I'm not surprised by any of the government's response so far. I mean, we could have talked about these things and probably did several years ago. We haven't seen anything that's surprising so far, you know, as you went through the laundry list from the rate cuts to the bailouts. But never, ever would I have imagined that we would, you know, that Fannie and Freddie would be nationalized at this point, that we would have to start guaranteeing the money funds at this point, that we would have a $700 billion bailout program. These things would happen so quickly before the economy has really entered the, well, I think now it's entering the recession, but before it's even started this adjustment period. To me, that's the most alarming aspect of this. Unfortunately, you know, things, subprime was much worse than I even thought. A lot of the excesses have been a lot worse than I even thought. And to me, it's all very disconcerting to watch this develop, because the economy will go through this adjustment period. There's no way around it. there's going to be enormous hardship and job losses and income loss. You know, unfortunately, we're just very early in this crisis.
Yeah, I want to get to another topic that I think is a ticking time bomb, and that's credit default swaps. On the day you and I are talking, I'm looking at a Bloomberg headline, corporate defaults may rise to 23% by 2010, S&P says. And originally, credit default swaps were a way of like sort of trying to buy insurance on a bond in case it went under. But Doug, I think we need to get into the issue that credit default swaps or bond insurance, whatever you want to call it, are so much different than, you know, you going out and buying, let's say, insurance on your car. Because I think this is another ticking time bomb here, and especially as we've been talking about the economic structure, which is where we're getting to when we're getting into corporate default rates.
Yeah, and I'll start out by saying I think it's important to recognize, and I was going through the Z1 report the other day. We have a new Federal Reserve flow of funds, their quarterly credit report, which is just a great report to go through. And it was very interesting to me that if you look at the numbers, year-over-year numbers, the GSEs, like their balance sheets, the GSE balance sheets have grown at $450 billion over the past year, a 16% rate. Mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie, they've grown at a 17% rate, almost $700 billion. Money market funds have grown at 34% over the past year. Bank deposits, 9.5% over the past year. This is that money that I'm talking about, and this is at the heart of why the economy has been much more resilient than many would have expected, considering the dislocation in risk assets and mortgages and housing. Even despite that major crisis in mortgages and housing, this money part of the economy has continued to grow rapidly. Well, we're saying now that everything has changed since the Lehman bankruptcy. Now, this money is not going to be able to grow rapidly. We're already seeing bank credit is basically stalled over the summer. The securitization markets have frozen up. The asset-backed security market's frozen up. So looking at the credit numbers and the dynamics in the market, I think it's a very safe bet now to say the economy will weaken and weaken rapidly. After being resilient over the past year because of the nature of the finance and we're able to continue to grow credit, that's going to change dramatically. So not only did the Lehman bankruptcy change the dynamic of still being able to grow credit here in the U.S., it also changed the dynamic of the counterparty risks in the derivatives market. And as you were mentioning, now that the credit system is frozen and the economy is going to go into a deep recession, now all of a sudden there's huge fears in the credit default swap market. Not only are there fears of counterparty, let's say a lot of players in the market had credit default swaps, bought, let's say, insurance from Lehman, so there's that problem because now they will be in bankruptcy court and may not be able to collect on that insurance, but also there's the issue of a lot of companies are really going to struggle as the economy goes into a recession. So now you have an almost panic in the credit default swap market. Because it's a very strange market because, you know, it's been sold as like an insurance market where you can just go in and insure yourself. If you think that General Motors is going to get in trouble, you can buy CDS, you can buy insurance against default by General Motors. So if General Motors defaults and you own this bond, then you can go and say, okay, I have insurance on this bond, pay me for the default, and you'll be okay. But the problem, and I've argued about this over the years and written about it, this, you know, credit is... it's not insurable. You know, if you think about insurance, if you think about buying collision insurance for your automobile or fire insurance for your house, you go to an insurance company. The insurance company has a lot of historical data. Their actuaries can look millions of examples, and they can come to calculations as far as, you know, the likelihood that your car is going to be in an accident, your house is going to be burned in a fire. And these, the autos and the home fires, these are random, independent events. They're insurable, right? That you can calculate the potential loss, you can charge enough for it, and then set aside reserves, and then down the road when these losses come, you can pay on them. Well, credit insurance, we've seen it in mortgages, in credit default swaps for corporations, etc. Credit losses come in waves. During the credit boom, you have very few losses, so the pricing of the risk declines. Plus, you know, in these new markets that we've had, you've had so many speculators come in, and they'll write this insurance, and you know they'll write the insurance, and whatever premium, we'll call it a premium, whatever they get for this insurance, they'll just keep it as profit. They don't set aside reserves. So not only is it not priced properly, because during the boom the losses are small, and during the bust the losses just explode, you have all these players, all these speculators that have come into these credit derivative markets, but they don't have the wherewithal to pay if you get into a systemic crisis, if you get into a credit bust. And that's the problem we're having right now in the credit default swap market. All of a sudden, the potential for huge losses and huge necessary payments on this insurance, are the probabilities are high, but these players don't have the wherewithal to live up to their obligations. And in so many cases, in contemporary finance, these models that were set up to play these different derivative markets, they use what's called dynamic hedging, where they'll say, okay, I can write this insurance on General Motors. Okay, I'll write this insurance and take this premium, and then if General Motors starts to get in trouble, I'll go out and short General Motors bonds, or I'll go out and short General Motors stock, so then that short sale, when I sell that stock or the bond and it goes down, then I'll have the cash from that transaction that I can pay on this insurance I've written. So these players don't have the wherewithal, and they don't set aside reserves. Instead, the models say, okay, I'll respond in the marketplace when it looks like I could lose on this insurance I've written, and I'll go out and short some. Well, we've seen now over the last few weeks in particular, well, we saw it in subprime also, that it doesn't work, because all of a sudden, when you have a crisis of confidence, you have overwhelming selling that comes in to hedge all these derivatives that have been written, and there's just no liquidity, and a lot of these markets can collapse. You know, we saw this dynamic, especially in the financial stocks, where if you get into a fears of a systemic crisis, there's just overwhelming selling pressure that comes to hedge various types of systemic risk that's been written in the marketplace. So the bottom line is, it's not insurance, and these are not markets. I've never believed that they would be viable over the downside of the credit cycle, because there's just not enough capital, there's not enough reserves to pay on these losses. Instead, you're going to have overwhelming selling orders hitting these various markets as guys try to hedge their exposure, and it's just not going to work. And I think that's where we are right now, especially over the last 2 weeks. You've seen it just doesn't work. So the government's had to step in and try to stabilize the system as the markets freeze up and become illiquid.
You know, the thing that I have seen where this started out sort of as an obscure type market in the banks for the original underwriters, then after the banks, you had insurance companies come in and hedge funds, and it got to be so competitive. And, you know, it's like anything else, Doug. If you're trying to buy bond insurance in good times, the firm that was writing the lowest premiums got the business. And the other thing is, as you know, with Wall Street, they play around with their computer models. And let's say there was a possibility of a 5% default rate. Well, if you could get that default rate down to 4% hypothetically, just the same way that they took junk bonds and turned them into AAA bonds, right, then what happens is your profit potential went up so much. And as you mentioned, the money wasn't set aside in an investment pool to say, all right, let's put this money aside, we'll make some investments, and here's the probability. So if something happens, we'll have the money there. They just got bigger returns to their hedge funds that year and bigger bonuses, and a lot of that money has been spent.
Absolutely. It's not there. I've often used the example of, it's like writing flood insurance during a drought. And the longer the drought and the more profits that the players are making writing this flood insurance during the drought, the more players that come in to play, and then the lower the premiums become. And the lower the premiums, and let's say the more building you'll have because flood insurance is so cheap, so now you'll buy the cheap flood insurance and build along the river. And then the more building you have, then the more demand for flood insurance, and the more players that come in and speculate. And it works fine until the torrential rain comes and there's just a mad panic because the players don't have the wherewithal to pay on what will be enormous losses, because the distortions in the flood insurance market led to, you know, a huge amount of building on the river, and they kind of fed on itself, right? The financial boom fed on the economic boom, and the two created a situation where when the inevitable flood came, that you would have a wipeout. But in this example, you know, writing flood insurance in a drought, that doesn't change the weather. It doesn't matter how many policies you write, it's not going to change the weather. And credit default swaps, it does change weather, because the more speculation you have in credit default swaps, and the cheaper the insurance is, the more demand that you'll have in the marketplace to buy these bonds and then buy the cheap insurance, the easier it is for the companies to come into the market and issue a lot of bonds. So the cheap insurance and the distortion in the insurance market leads to the credit excess and feeds the credit bubble, which when the inevitable bubble bursts, then you have a real big problem because the excesses have grown so dramatically, and I really think that's the real problem in the corporate bond market right now is, the credit default swap market has been driving corporate issuance. Now that there are serious problems in the credit default swap market, well, we're already seeing it, that corporations are, if they are able to raise money in the bond market right now, they're paying dearly for it. So again, this is, again, what has changed over the last couple of weeks. It may seem subtle, but in many cases, it's profound. I think, right now we're seeing a major upheaval in the corporate bond market. We're seeing major upheaval in the municipal bond market. And these are the markets that really drive the economy. A lot of the tumult we saw in the past year in the mortgage market, that had a huge impact on home prices, especially in some locations. And it had some economic impact because of the deceleration in home building. But what we're seeing today is going to get right to the heart of the real economy. We're seeing auto dealers close down because they can't get financed for new customers. We're going to see state and local spending slow dramatically. Again, this is why I think it's important for listeners to realize that as far as the economy goes, the financial developments over the last 2 weeks are critically important.
Doug Noland of the Credit Bubble Bulletin, interviewed by Jim Poplava of FinancialSense.com. That's Sense, S-E-N-S-E. In order to boost profits, capitalists pursued two basic strategies beginning in the 1970s. Downsizing by replacing workers with automation, and wars to obtain cheap raw materials by setting up dictatorships that would not allow wages to rise or the environment to be defended. By the 1990s, advances in telecommunications and computer networking made total capital mobility possible. With the pushing through of the so-called free trade globalization regime, they were able to move manufacturing to other parts of the world where they could exploit and pollute to their heart's content, beginning the Industrial Revolution process again in places like China. But what were they to do with millions of Americans who were now too poorly paid to buy, and furthermore, who were rioting and protesting? Prisons were built for some millions, and easy credit was made available to buy off the rest. That has its limits, which have now been reached economically and ecologically. The powers that be have known that for some time, even if they don't admit it to the public. But they do have a plan B they're not touting on national TV. It's outlined in an article by Bill Van Auken, published on the World Socialist website on September 25th, and widely republished on many independent media sites. The article is titled, Army Deploys Combat Unit in U.S. for Possible Civil Unrest. Van Auken writes, for the first time ever, the U.S. military is deploying an active duty regular Army combat unit for full-time use inside the United States to deal with emergencies, including potential civil unrest. Beginning on October 1st, the 1st Brigade Combat Team of the 3rd Division will be placed under the command of U.S. Army North, the Army's component of the Pentagon's Northern Command, NORTHCOM, which was created in the wake of September 11, 2001 attacks, with a stated mission of defending the U.S. homeland and aiding federal, state, and local authorities. The unit, known as the Raiders, is among the Army's most blooded. It has spent nearly 3 out of the last 5 years deployed in Iraq, leading the assault on Baghdad in 2003 and carrying out house-to-house combat in the suppression of resistance in the city of Ramadi. This was the 1st Brigade Combat Team to be sent to Iraq 3 times. While active duty units previously have been used on temporary assignments, such as the combat-equipped troops deployed in New Orleans, which was effectively placed under martial law in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, this marks the first time that an Army combat unit has been given a dedicated assignment in which U.S. soil constitutes its battle zone. The Pentagon's official pronouncements have stressed the role of specialized units in a potential response to terrorist attack within the U.S. General George Casey, the Army Chief of Staff, attended a training exercise last week for about 250 members of the unit at Fort Stewart, Georgia. The focus of the exercise, according to the Army's Public Affairs Office, was how troops, quote, might fly search and rescue missions, extract casualties, and decontaminate people following a catastrophic nuclear attack in the nation's heartland, close quote. We are at war with a global extremist network that is not going away, Casey told the soldiers. I hope we don't have to use it, but we need the capability. However, the mission assigned to the nearly 4,000 troops of the 1st Brigade Combat Team does not consist merely of rescuing victims of terrorist attacks. An article that appeared earlier this month in the Army Times, a publication that is widely read within the military, paints a different and far more ominous picture. The article titled Brigade Homeland Tours Start October 1st said, quote, they may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control. It quotes the unit's commander, Colonel Robert Cloutier, as saying that the 1st BCT's soldiers are being trained in the use of the first ever non-lethal package the Army has fielded. The weapons, the paper reported, are, quote, designed to subdue unruly or dangerous individuals without killing them, close quote. The equipment includes beanbag bullets, shields and batons, and equipment for erecting roadblocks. It appears that as part of the training for deployment within the U.S., the soldiers have been ordered to test some of this non-lethal equipment on each other. I was the first guy in the brigade to get tasered, Cloutier told the Army Times. He described the effects of the electroshock weapon as, quote, your worst muscle cramp ever, 10 times throughout your whole body, close quote. The colonel's remarks suggest that in preparation for their home front duties, rank-and-file troops are also being routinely tasered. The brutalizing effect and intent of such a macabre training exercise is to inure troops against sympathy for the pain and suffering they may be called upon to inflict on the civilian population using these same so-called non-lethal weapons. According to military officials quoted by the Army Times, the deployment of regular Army troops in the U.S. begun with the 1st Brigade Combat Team is to become permanent, with different units rotated into the assignment on an annual basis. In an online interview with reporters earlier this month, NORTHCOM officers were asked about the implications of the new deployment for the Posse Comitatus Act, the 230-year-old legal statute that bars the use of U.S. military forces for law enforcement purposes within the U.S. itself. Colonel Lou Volger, NORTHCOM's chief of future operations, tried to downplay any enforcement role but added, quote, we will integrate with law enforcement to understand the situation and make sure we're aware of any threats, close quote. Volger acknowledged the obvious, that the brigade combat team is a military force, while attempting to dismiss the likelihood that it would play any military role. It has forces for security, he said, but that's really, they call them security forces. But that's really just to establish our own footprint and make sure that we can operate and run our own bases, close quote. Lieutenant Colonel James Shores, another NORTHCOM officer, chimed in. Let's say even if there was a scenario that developed into a branch of civil disturbance, even at that point it would take a presidential directive to even get close to anything you're suggesting, close quote. Whatever is required to trigger such an intervention, clearly Colonel Cloutier and his troops are preparing for it with their hands-on training in the use of, quote, non-lethal means of repression. The extreme sensitivity of the military brass on this issue notwithstanding, the reality is that the intervention of the military in domestic affairs has grown sharply over the last period, under conditions in which its involvement in two colonial-style wars abroad has given it a far more prominent role in American political life. The Bush administration has worked to tear down any barriers to the use of the military in domestic repression. Thus, in the 2007 Pentagon spending bill, it inserted a measure to amend the Posse Comitatus Act to clear the way for the domestic deployment of the military in the event of natural disaster, terrorist attack, or, quote, other conditions in which the president determines that domestic violence has occurred to the extent that state officials cannot maintain public order, close quote. The provision granted the president sweeping new powers to impose martial law by declaring a public emergency for virtually any reason, allowing him to deploy troops anywhere in the U.S. and to take control of state-based National Guard units without the consent of state governors in order to suppress public disorder. The provision was subsequently repealed by Congress as part of the 2008 military appropriations legislation. But the intent remains. Given the sweeping powers claimed by the White House in the name of the Commander-in-Chief in a global war on terror, powers to suspend habeas corpus, carry out wholesale domestic spying, and conduct torture, there is no reason to believe it would respect legal restrictions against the use of military force at home. It is noteworthy that the deployment of U.S. combat troops as an on-call federal response force for natural or man-made emergencies and disasters, close quote, in the words of the Army Times, coincides with the eruption of the greatest economic emergency and financial disaster since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Justified as a response to terrorist threats, the real source of the growing preparations for the use of the U.S. military within America's borders lies not in the events of September 11, 2001, or the danger that they will be repeated. Rather, the domestic mobilization of the armed forces is a response by the U.S. ruling establishment to the growing threat to political stability. Under conditions of deepening economic crisis, the unprecedented social chasm separating the country's working people from the obscenely wealthy financial elite becomes unsustainable within the existing political framework. That an article by Bill Van Auken, Army Deploys Combat Unit in U.S. for Possible Civil Unrest, published September 25th on the World Socialist website, wsws.org. Some people have speculated as to whether the economic crisis will be used as an excuse to cancel the November elections. Others that an attack on Iran will be used for similar purposes. Then, there's also the possibility of public outrage at more of the same election rigging that occurred in 2000 and 2004. For those of you who do believe in the American Republic, what are you prepared to do? The oft-cited American revolutionists, the so-called founding fathers, whatever one may think of them, did indeed pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to bring about the society they wanted. If the society one wants is one with more forests, more songbirds, more wild fish, more equality, fewer jails, and less exploitation, what are we prepared to do? This was the topic of a conversation I had last week with environmentalist and award-winning author Derek Jensen, who was in the Finger Lakes to give a workshop on deep green resistance and a lecture on his latest book, Endgame. You've said before that the responsibility of a predator is to perpetuate its prey, to not extinguish the life of its prey. But we have a society that says, oh, it's fine to extinguish things. We'll just find a new technology to replace whatever we've destroyed. And then the people who are trying to call people back to some sanity on this issue are now branded as terrorists. We've witnessed a recent spectacle of people chanting, drill, 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 in a huge stadium. And here in our magical part of the world, there's an army of gas drillers lining up to invade us and destroy us. So you're here to talk about deep green resistance. What is that?
Well, I think that there's a bunch of questions inherent in your question. And one of them is that what I actually said about the predators is that that's the deal, that's the bargain that a predator makes with prey, is that if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. And that's true on a moral level, and it's true on a woo-woo cosmic level, and it's true on a straight carbon cycle level too, in terms of if the bears eat all the salmon, there won't be any salmon left for them to eat in the future. And so it goes, in that sense, it goes to the nature of evolution, that we've all been told that evolution is based on hierarchy and, I'm sorry, that evolution is based on competition, survival, the fittest, the meanest. And really, you know, to show how stupid our discourse is, I can disprove that in one sentence with a couple semicolons, which is that those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run. And you don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. You survive in the long run by actually making your habitat better. And now to jump to the part about drill, 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 is that it's insane. And I'm using that term in its most basic sense of out of touch with physical reality, to think that you can destroy a planet and live on it. And, you know, we can talk about whatever measure you want, whether it's, you know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, or there are 6 to 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the oceans now, and the oceans are being murdered, and they're well nigh murdered at this point, and migratory songbird populations are collapsing, and whippoorwill populations are down by about 80% in the last 40 years. Bobwhite populations by 70%. Chickadee populations down by, I think, 60%. And here we are with
lawnmowing.
You know, that's what we hear, is a lawnmower instead of wild creatures. And so, anyway, all these populations are collapsing, and the response by mainstream environmentalists to migratory songbird populations collapsing is that, this is a direct quote, that it's not an emergency. And I can guarantee that if GNP went down by 80%, or if the stock market went down by 80% in 40 years, they would be declaring this an emergency. And it's just, it's stunning how in this culture people are, they don't understand that the real world is what's real. And we can get to that more later. But now back to deep green resistance. Deep green resistance is simply asking the question, what are we going to do about the fact that this culture is killing the planet? How are we going to stop it? And it's about acting as if the real world is more important than this economic system. What are we going to do? And what are we going to do if we truly recognize that the real world is what's primary?
I am astonished when I hear the discourse about climate change, that there are people who are advocating for policies and they feel they have to justify it on the impact on the economy. So clearly they're not really taking it seriously as something that is life-threatening to continued existence. And I have known about these issues since the 1970s. That's when people started to first talk about these things. This is decades now. So do you have any insight as to what is wrong with the human species as a whole, that we are failing to take the necessary actions to preserve ourselves?
Well, two things. One is my first degree was in physics at the Colorado School of Mines, and I remember a class in 1982 in which the professor was talking about the possibility of runaway global warming and talking about the dynamics of it. And that's, what, 26 years ago now? So, yeah, this is not news. And that you raise such an important point, and that's when think about what all of the mainstream solutions to global warming or any of the problems that this culture is causing, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take this economic system as primary and the real world as secondary, as that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And once again, that's insane, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Because I have news for people, which is that the real physical world is primary, and you can't have an economic system without having a real physical world. I was doing this interview on the radio maybe a couple years ago. It's a terrible interview. It was this right-wing, anti-environmental, property rights uberallers Bible thumper who I was talking about 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. I was talking about, which people can talk about blithely, by the way. I mean, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And, you know, ho-hum, you know, who's gonna win in the, you know, is Boston College going to win a football game tomorrow? You know, this is like, and what's going to happen? You know, the Yankees didn't make the World Series this year. And people are so blithe about the oceans being murdered. And anyway, I was doing this interview. I was talking about how there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk, and how you can't be anywhere without hearing all these machines. You know, it's, no matter what level we're talking about, I was talking about all this stuff, but especially dioxin in every mother's breast milk. People, everybody I know has loved someone that has died of cancer, which is caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Every stream. Every mother's breast milk in the world. And I'm saying all this stuff, and the guy keeps saying the same thing, which is, you know, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. And what he meant by the real world is industrial capitalism. And that's how a lot of people use the language every day, is, you know, kids in college, they'll say, so what are you going to do when you get in the real world? And what they mean is, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? You know, here's what I'm going to do when I get out in the real world. I'm going to roll around in the dirt. That's the real world. So people don't know what the real world is. That's part of it. And beyond that, you know, I've written 13 books about this, or 15 books about this, or however many. It still doesn't make any sense to me. I can't. It doesn't matter how much I write it. It makes no sense that people are watching the world be murdered as though it's a video game and they can just go back and, you know, save it and go back and do it right next time. But this is the real physical world. And, you know, one of the things that makes more sense than almost anything else I've read is that is Jack Forbes, American Indian, wrote this book called Columbus and Other Cannibals, in which he talks about, he believes that the problem is a spiritual illness with a physical vector. That people, like if I have the flu and I cough, you can pick up the flu symptoms. But he thinks that it's a spiritual illness, that if I cough, if I have the cannibal sickness and I cough, then you can become a cannibal and have to consume the souls of others in order to live. You become a vampire, basically. And that, frankly, makes more sense than any of the analysis I've done, because what's the use of retiring rich on a planet being murdered? And it's stunning to me that you get... My book Endgame was really premised on the idea, the question, do you believe that there will be a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody I know says yes. And the next question is, what does that mean for our strategy and for our tactics? And the answer is, we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that somehow there'll be this magical transformation. And it's not going to happen. And so if you care about life on Earth, what does that mean? You know, I mean, the short answer to your question of... Well, first off, I don't think it's human species, by the way. I don't live here, so I don't know whose land this is, but I live on Talawa land in way, way northern California.
It's the Haudenosaunee land.
Okay, and how long did they live here?
I don't know, 20,000 years without destroying it, right?
Yeah, so it's not a human problem.
Right.
And that's really important for a reason I'll get to. And with the Talawa, I just want to finish that thought. The Talawa lived there for 12,500 years if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talawa, they lived there since the beginning of time. The point is, it's a long time. It's at least 600 human generations. So 20,000 years would be what? 900 human generations at least, and once again, they didn't destroy it. And so you would think that we would ask, how did they live differently? That what was the difference between their way of living and this way of living such that they didn't destroy it? And there are many people who think, oh, it's just because, you know, they didn't invent backhoes. Well, that's really racist. That's what you're suggesting, is that they were too stupid to invent the internal combustion engine. Sorry, that doesn't work. It's they lived entirely differently. And the, you know, all the indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners, if you're listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really works, that the civilized, the people in this culture, generally perceive trees as a timber resource, not as being fully alive and having something to say and having a life that's just as valuable to it as my life is to me and your life is to you. But the truth is that, you know, this grass is alive and full of its own intelligence, and the ant that was just crawling on my arm is just as alive and just as full of its own intelligence as I am. And it's not a different quantity of intelligence, it's a different type. And I see no evidence that humans are any smarter than anyone else. And once again, that's the fundamental difference, is that the people who lived here before, the Talawa who lived, one of the things is that they perceived the stones as having something to say. They perceived everyone. This it's a huge symphony of mutual respect and a huge dance of life and death. And this culture doesn't perceive that. This culture perceives everyone as resources, as how can you use them. And that's a big, big problem, because if you perceive the world as consisting of resources, you will use it up, as opposed to the world consisting of other beings with whom you can and should enter into relationship. Which, to go back to your first question, doesn't mean that you can't kill and eat them. That, you know, but what it means is that you have to have the deal you make is when you consume the flesh of a salmon from the Klamath River near where I live, that then that means that you enter into a relationship with the salmon where you will guarantee that you will not guarantee, but you will, it's your responsibility to make sure that they continue, and not in a stewardship sort of way, which is over, but instead responsibility comes from the root, respondere, which means to give in return. And it's, what do you give back? It's a mutual relationship. What do I give to the salmon? What do I give to the forest where I live? And this culture, everything's one way. Everything is all about taking. And I'm not saying that, oh, what that means is we need to be less greedy, because the problems are way beyond that, because you could be less greedy, I could be less greedy, we could just kill ourselves for that matter, and this culture would still be killing the planet. There we need to stop this culture from killing the planet. There are bigger systemic and basically this culture has turned people into sociopaths, and who can have a whole stadium chanting drill, 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 which of course any feminist is going to make a heyday out of too, because, you know, we can also talk about 25% of all women in this culture are raped in their lifetime, another 19% fend off rape attempts, so there's a lot of men who are saying drill, drill, drill. Don't know if you want to go there, but that's...
Sure, I'll go anywhere you want to go.
That's part of it too, because it's not,
I mean,
just...
I don't think you can divorce
separate.
That. No, absolutely not.
Gender oppression was the first hierarchical society, the first iteration, and that paradigm has spread out to every other thing. I mean, so we don't just destroy the natural world and consume it. We do that to other members of our own species as well.
Well, we don't. You don't.
Yes.
I'm speaking generically.
I think that's
really important to separate. And one of the reasons it's important to separate is because, once again, a lot of indigenous people say that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds and to separate ourselves from that. So people can say to me, and this is a joke I love to tell, but a friend of mine called and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I'm like, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California. And then my friend said, so how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I said, I got troops? Will they do what I tell them? If I tell them to take out the Grand Coulee, will they do it? It's like, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks, Derek, and hung up. And the point is that I think it's really important for us to separate and to say, I mean, I'm not a rapist. and to say, yes, I am, I have a penis, but I don't identify with patriarchy, and I am doing everything I can to stop it. And yes, I am also insane in terms of I will never know what it is like to have grown up in a non-exploitative culture. And I will claim that, but at the same time, and I hope this isn't coming across as chastising you, because I'm not. I'm just...
Oh, no, 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 because I have a response to that when you
okay,
get
go ahead.
Through, which is I understand the point that you're making, but here's why I chose to put it that way, is because even though I despise all these things that we're talking about, I have not stopped it. I haven't gone in there with a submachine gun and gunned down the board of directors of Halliburton or pick whatever. You know, as I said, because I haven't stopped them, I feel a responsibility for everything they do. And this comes from me, from my family. My mother was a Holocaust survivor, and my grandmother. So all those people, and you can make this metaphor, because what we're doing to the whole earth and to, you know, all of the world is a Holocaust.
Or what
okay.
they're doing.
Yes, what they're doing, what humans are doing. And, I mean, I'm doing it too. I drove here in a car, right?
Okay,
I mean, so what I'm saying is that I'm living in this civilization, consuming all this garbage. Right. Even no matter how I try to do things differently, I'm still doing all these things, right? So I can't say, oh, I'm great, and all you people, you know. So that's why I put it that way. And all those people who didn't do anything to stop, you know, and who don't do anything to stop something are complicit by having allowed it to go on. And so I have to put myself in that category as much as I dislike being there. That's why I say it that way.
Okay. I don't disagree with you at all. I think that that's a really important point. And at the same time, I think that for me at least, an important first step is to separate. And I don't think that, to talk about the Capital H Holocaust, I don't think that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising would say, we're doing this. And I think, yes, the good Germans would, but what about the members of the German resistance? And what about those, whether they were Jewish or not, who did resist? And so, and I think that you are resisting by raising these issues. That's part of it. Even the IRA at its strongest, only about 3% of the people were carrying weapons. 97% were doing support work. And that's true for a regular military, and it's true for every sort of resistance. And so, I mean, I beat myself up all the time because I'm writing books. I've got a pretty famous line. It's quoted all the time about every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And the point of that is that, yes, the analysis is really important, but it's like Carl Jung said, philosophy butters no parsnips. And, you know, discourse itself doesn't accomplish anything in the real physical world. We can change hearts, we can encourage people, we can do all this analysis that's really important, but at some point, something has to happen in the real physical world. And so, yeah, I you know, sort of beat myself up because I'm only writing. But then also, I have to step back and realize that this is the discourse. What you're doing right now is part of what needs to happen. So yes, you are resisting, and I fully agree that, you know, people ask, you know, is your work successful? And, you know, by you know, I've got what 13, 14, whatever, however many books out, and, you know, so on that level it's successful. But really, it's going to be measured on a 0-1 scale, which is does it help to stop this culture from killing the planet? And that's true about whether we're talking, or whether we're taking out rapists, or whether we're, you know, stopping a corporation through some means, or whether we're filing lawsuits. It doesn't matter what the tactics that we're talking about there. The question really is, do we stop this culture? And the people who come after are not going to care about whether we wrote really good books. They're not going to care about whether we recycled. They're not going to care about whether we did or didn't drive. They're not going to care about, you know, how hard we tried. They're not going to care about whether we filed these lawsuits, not going to care who we voted for. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and breathe the air. And so if your work in doing this contributes to that and we win, then yes, you will not have been one of them. And it's the same with me. If my work contributes to us stopping them, then yes, I will not have been one of them. But if it doesn't, then it doesn't really matter. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, I do.
And I'm a big believer in process. You know, I mean, I think it's really important to you know, live one's life being, you know, doing what one wants to do, to be being happy. I think process is really important. But this is actually one case where, or in a relationship, you know, it's like years ago I was talking to Dolores LaChapelle, who wrote this great book, Sacred Land, Sacred Sex. I interviewed her. And all through the interview, we're talking about sacred land and what's sort of sacred relationship with land. And I'm getting up, at the end of the interview, I'm getting up to leave. And I thank her and I say, oh, by the way, we didn't talk about what sacred sex is. What's sacred sex? And she said, oh, it's really simple. Sex without orgasm. I'm like, what? And she said, think about it. You'll get it. And she wasn't really talking about sex without orgasm. But what she was talking about is that oftentimes the point of sex is orgasm. Then it becomes product oriented, just another capitalist production system. Let's get an orgasm, as opposed to a process. And the point is, what she was saying is the sacrality, the sacredness of process. And, you know, I think in the way you're nodding, I think we both fully agree on that process is extremely important. But we're talking about life on the planet. Process doesn't matter here. What's important? I got an argument with a pacifist one time because I was saying the thing about the people who come after are not going to care about whether, you know, all this other, they're going to care about whether the land will support their lives. And he was shaking his head and he disagreed and he emotionally violently disagreed that he was saying, no, you know, that what they're going to care about is the process that we go through to get there and that we have to, you know, use, you know, acceptable means or whatever. And, you know, honestly, this area should be full of passenger pigeons. I mean, the sky, there were so many passenger pigeons, they would darken the sky from horizon to horizon for days at a time. Flocks of billions of birds. And honestly, if somebody would have done what was necessary to save the passenger pigeons, I wouldn't care about the means. I just want for there to be passenger pigeons. It's the same. I wouldn't care about... And what I care about is living in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and that's more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and that has less dioxin in every mother's breast milk, and that has more large fish in the oceans. That's what I care about. How we get there is not so important to me. And I don't understand, since we are talking about life on the planet, I honestly cannot understand any other perspective, because the bottom line has to be, is and must be, the real physical world.
Okay, let me ask you something about you to see if that, you know, what insights there are. When you were studying physics at the Colorado School of Mines, at that point, at the time that you began there, what was your outlook? What were you thinking? Was it the same as now? And at what point did your outlook change, if it did, from some point early on in your life? What brought you to the passionate understanding that you now have? Because I'm looking for, like, what takes people from here to there?
Right. Well, that's a great question, too, and all your questions are really great. And that, what was I thinking? What I was thinking at the time was that I didn't have the money to go to school anywhere else, and I got a scholarship in engineering, and if you can get a scholarship and to go to a school in engineering, that's what you do. Never mind the fact I didn't really like it. And when I talked to other people at the school who didn't really like what they were doing either, their response was that when they got out, they were going to buy a Mustang, a car, and they would have money. And, you know, that's the attitude that so many people have. It's getting a good job. That's the point of life, is to get a good job, evidently. And so one of the things that really –